Eric Clapton and J.J. Cale have been part of each other's music for a long, long time, with Eric having great success with his version of the Okies' laid-back tunes. Now they finally record together on the new album, The Road to Escondido. Our World Cafe producer, Kimberly Janot, had a chance to sit down and talk with the two musical legends. We'll find out a lot about their musical past, how they feel about celebrity, and to start off, the genesis of this project. Eric Clapton tells how it all began.
In my mind's eye, I thought one day I'm going to ask him to make a record, and I wanted to say to him, I want to sound like you, but I want to still be me, you know what I mean? Because he, for me, in my experience listening to music all these years, has still learned how to make records properly, and so that you could listen to them 10 years from now and you wouldn't get bored. And that's what I wanted. So I asked him, and he said, yeah, and that was it.
What is it in particular that you admire about him?
His overall philosophy. I mean, and I think his music is part and parcel of the way he looks at everything. And you know, but of course, I didn't know that until I got to know him. And that's just who he is. His music is a reflection of who he is. And the way you first get it as a listener is that it's genuine. It has sincerity. And it has roots. And his music has really clear, easy-to-hear roots.
How did you two work together on the new album?
Together.
I went down and stayed with him for a week and to try, because I'd heard that he'd sent me a disc with all the songs that he'd written on and some other suggestions, and I decided we'd do all the ones he'd written, and I had a couple of ideas, and this thing that we did with John Mayer, but I went and stayed with John, and we practiced in a way. I mean, I learned to play. The important thing for me to try and do was to learn how to play and sing these songs at the same time, because as straightforward as that sounds, it's sometimes quite difficult to get the two things, you know, playing a constant rhythm or something that's nice with the guitar and then sing. Because I wanted to be able to do the thing all in one go. I mean, my ideal thing is to do a live vocal, you know, when you can. And I like that thing when the band kind of bleeds into the vocal mic and you just get this better sound. So I was trying to do that. We almost got there. But that's what we did for the first week. And then we went into the studio with the musicians that we wanted to play with, and we invited a few people. And so we had a lot of people in the room with us, and we tried to do as much of it live as we could. And where it was necessary to fix things or, you know, do them again or redo the vocals, we did that in the period between then and now, really. So that right up until about 2 months ago, we were still making tiny little adjustments and changes to get it as good as we could get it, you know.
How did you meet John Mayer?
John came to the festival that we did in 2004. I invited him to come and play. So a friend of mine in New York turned me on to him, played me his first album, and said, you've got to see this guy play. I mean, he makes great records, but you have to see him play to really know what he's got to offer. And when he played at Crossroads, I sat on the side of the stage and watched him, you know, play the blues like most of the great players can play. And I was very impressed, and so I thought, well, you know, we ought to get together, and we sat down and wrote a couple of songs in the beginning of last year, and one of these when we put on the album.
Did you write the lyrics for that song, or did he?
50-50. It was 50-50 right down the line. He had the first line, and I completed the verse, and he had a couple of the changes, and I put in a couple more. So it was really a half and a half job.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out whose perspective was it from.
Oh, he wrote, you know, funnily enough, the perspective is his. The actual sentiment of, like, I've seen it all, that's John. Because that's where he's at right now.
That's what I was wondering about, because he's only 29.
I know. Well, yeah, people can get to that point in their teens, you know. You know what it's like. I mean, it's a kind of adolescent point of view, in a way. I mean, in 5 years' time, I know he'll feel entirely different. But I think he does feel like that right now.
Hard to thrill, nothing really moves me anymore. Hard to thrill, nothing really moves me anymore. There is nothing you can show me that I haven't seen before.
Now, Sporting Life Blues, that's the only traditional song on the album. How did you guys decide to do that one?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah.
Eric brought that in. He thought that fit us old geezers, and it does.
Yeah. It's a song I've always wanted to do, and I've never really had the opportunity or the right sort of atmosphere to do it, the right framework to do it in. And it's been in my consciousness since I was a kid. You know, I heard it when I was a kid. I used to play it a bit as a kid. And this, I thought, this is perfect for this.
I got a letter from my home. Most of my friends are dead and gone. I began to worry. I began to wonder about days to come. My mother used to talk to me. I was young and foolish, could not see. Now I got no mother, my sisters and brothers don't care for me.
We're talking to Eric Clapton and J.J. Cale today on the World Cafe. So were both of your families supportive of you doing music when you were kids? Like
Mine was a musical family. Everyone sang. It was we had a piano somewhere in the house. We had a tiny little house, and a little upright piano. And whenever anyone had a couple of drinks, which was quite frequent, and they'd start singing the hits of the day. And everyone sang. It was good. It was a lot of music in my house when I was a kid.
And you, Jay?
Yeah, my mother and father were. They knew that. You can't make a living playing music. I mean, that was especially in those days. Guitar was not as popular. Eric Clapton actually popularized the guitar. You're sitting here for the person who changed the guitar. It's acceptable now. Kids don't want to be doctors and lawyers. They think they'll be rich by playing the guitar. I'm just kidding there, folks. But what I'm trying to say is guitar was not that popular. So, and they kind of knew, but they never ever said, hey, you got to quit. They said, if that's what you want to do, you can do that. So, it was acceptable. They were also realists. They, one musician out of the, 100,000 makes any money. Mm.
When did you both know that this is what you wanted to do? Was there a point at which you knew that this is what you wanted to do?
Well, I had originally gone to art school to train to be a stained glass designer, and that was really interesting to me, and I like working with my hands, I always have done. And at some point, the music overrode that, and the two at one little point when I was about 16, the two things were neck and neck. And because of that, I got thrown out of school because I wasn't concentrating on work and I was well behind everybody else in terms of productivity. And they threw me out, and I thought, well, I don't know what I'm going to do, but the only thing I can do right now is play. So I started playing in pubs. I got a job working in construction for my grandfather, and that was hard work. I did that for about a year, and in the evenings I would go and play in pubs, and I was making as much money eventually playing the guitar as I was on the building site. So then I got asked to join a band, which as soon as I started to get a wage packet from that, I knew that was it. I mean, I've never really considered it a job. It's what I love to do, and I'm very lucky and fortunate to be paid for doing something that I love to do. And I think we're all, most of us are very fortunate in that respect.
How about you, Jim?
Yeah, I never... It just kind of slowly evolved. I thought I was eventually going to quit doing that kid stuff, playing music. That's for kids and people who had time on their hands and didn't need to support themselves. ironically, as the years went by, it just kind of slowed. But I didn't have any plan at all. I had no idea that I'd be a songwriter or a singer or a guitar player. I just kind of, I think I'll do this. I'll tell you one thing. I spent a lot of time trying to avoid any kind of work. I mean, if I get me a gig on Friday night that paid $15, and I would take that, and of course, when you start doing that, you can't maintain a day job. And so it was a slow thing that just kind of, all at once I woke up, I was about 35 years old, and I was playing music and didn't have a job, and I went, oh, well, what the hell?
When you were kids, were there particular songs or a particular artist that really inspired you to go into music?
When I was real young, that's for rock and roll, if you can believe that. That's how old I am. And they played country music around where I lived, and Hank Williams. And
Tulsa.
And then rock and roll hit when I was a teenager. Well, boy, this is Little Richard, Fats Domino, Elvis Presley, Chuck Berry, that era. That's kind of music of my teenage years that influenced me the most. So I've always thought that was some of the best, even though I don't try to even get in that bag as a musician or whatever. But as a non-musician, and I am a musician, but looking at it as a non-musician, that was the music that impressed me. And it's because of those, it's those years. And everybody's a victim of about 12 years old till about 18. What they go into stays with them for the rest of their life, and the next generation's music sucks. That's not a blanket thing, but a lot do. I've found that most people just, I meet 50-year-old people in there. It was the Beatles era and Bob Dylan, and they just don't care anything about the new stuff, nor do they care anything. They don't care anything about the Frank Sinatra big band era of their mom. So music is, to the person who's not in music, is very generational. Luckily, us musicians are a little broader than that. We have to be, because that's what we do.
What instrument did you first start playing?
I played piano and guitar about the same time. My sister had a piano at the house, and I gravitated to guitar. There was a kid up the street playing the guitar, and I'd always borrow his guitar and play it. So guitar was it.
Did you start out on an acoustic guitar?
Ironically, no. I got a job. I spotted a Les Paul as a 50. It was the first year. I think 52 was the first year that a Les Paul guitar, for the you folks out there know what that is, it's a solid body guitar made by Gibson. And I got a job in a root beer stand washing dishes and fry cooking, and went down at the music store and bought. I remember it was $210, and I made payments on that. And up to that time, I borrowed a kid's acoustic guitar and played rhythm guitar in bands and stuff. But I got me a day job and got a gold Les Paul. I think mine was a 54. The first ones were 1952, and I was about 15, 16 years old. Later years of my high school.
How about you, Eric? What did you start on?
I got my first guitar when I was about 13, and it was a Spanish-looking guitar. It was a German guitar. It was called a Hoyer, but it had steel strings. It was an odd combination, and it was very, very difficult to play, and with a very high action. And it wasn't very expensive. It was a fairly cheap guitar that my grandparents bought for me. And, I couldn't play. I found it so... I was so disillusioned about what it looked like to play the guitar and what it felt like that I gave up quite quickly. And then I started again about 2 years later, and I got hold of another guitar, electric guitar, semi-acoustic K. And that was pretty much the same thing. Very high action, but it sounded so much better. And all the people that I was kind of looking up to were playing Fenders, actually, except Chuck Berry was playing a big Gibson semi-acoustic, but Buddy Holly, for instance, was playing, and he was my hero when I was a kid, my first real guitar hero. And the reason I liked him so much, more than the others, like Elvis and those other, and Gene Vincent, was that he looked like he was an ordinary guy, and he wore glasses. And I thought, this is something that anyone can aspire to. You don't have to look like a Greek god, And so he was my big hero, and he played a Fender Stratocaster. So that's, and after I finally got some money, I started buying, you know, real guitars, and I bought what John was talking about. I bought a Gibson Les Paul, and then I bought a Fender Telecaster, and then there was no stopping me, and I've been collecting ever since.
How many do you have right now?
I don't have that many. I've sold a couple of hundred over the last, you know, 10 years. I've owned maybe 300 at any one time, you know, and they get, and it's an insatiable habit. Yeah, with me. Whenever I go really on the road, yeah. I get check into a hotel and I go down the, and I want to know where the pawn shop is, yeah. You know, and I go looking for bargains, and of course that doesn't happen. You know, they're all gone now. All the great guitars.
Yeah, right.
You know, if you're looking to buy a Les Paul now, it will cost you anywhere up to $500,000. Right.
I heard that they someone bought your Blackie guitar. He's going to make copies of it, and then the money will go to your Crossroads.
To Crossroads Antigua, yeah, that's right. Yeah, $275 will be made of that model, and I don't know what they're selling it for, but it won't be cheap.
I heard $24,000.
Good God. Well, it's a good cause.
Yeah.
It's a good cause.
Back to producer Kimberly Janod's interview with Eric Clapton and J.J. Cale. Their new CD is called The Road to Escondido.
One of the other songs besides After Midnight that you covered that Jay was Cocaine. Mm. And I was wondering what was the circumstances around you writing that one?
That's me being an observer. I was just, you know, I think I've said this kind of a scenario before. It's like writing about that lamp over there. If you write about that lamp, you go, the name of this song's That Lamp Over There, if you follow that crazy way of talking about it. And I just seen Cocaine was everywhere to a lot of people I knew and people I didn't know, and it was a big thing in the 70s. And I just wrote a song about it, and, you know, the hardest part's getting it all to rhyme. You know, really, once you get the hook, which Cocaine, the word is a hook, I had no idea that I didn't think it. I actually wrote it. I'm a big fan of Mose Allison. I wrote it in what I call cocktail jazz kind of style, you know, kind of swing kind of thing. And Audie, the guy I was working with at the time, Audie Ashworth, producer and publisher, whatever you want to call him, good friend, helped me make records, said, John, I really like that song. He said, can you make that more contemporary, more rock and roll? And so I went back in and cut it again and put the riff on it and hired a drummer. But the original version was a Mose Allison kind of swishy kind of a thing. But that's all the songs I've ever written, whether it be Cocaine or After Midnight or whatever. I'm just like any other songwriter. I'm just always, you know, well, I think I'll write a song about this, the bed in there. I'll write a song about you. What's your name? And I'll write a song about me. Some of them are fiction. Some of them are fact. And you never know till you get through the song and you look at it yourself. And then you kind of judge on whether you liked it or not. I didn't think Cocaine was that hot. Apparently a lot of people did. I thought, you know, they'll never touch this. And a lot of them thought that way too, you know, because it's like Eric's had that problem. So, you know, well, should I keep singing this song, you know? And like I said to somebody else the other day, it's just a song about a subject that has existed in a lot of people's lives and has affected a lot of other people's lives that didn't take cocaine, period.
There was another song called Cocaine way back I used to play in the pubs, and it was I play at Clawhammer Stars, Cocaine All Around My Brain. It was an old folk song.
Right.
But the thing that would happen when you play, I mean, as an 18-year-old playing in pubs who'd never been anywhere near cocaine but knew how kind of dark and exciting and dangerous it was supposed to be to sit in a pub and play a song. When you get to that word, you say cocaine, you think, oh, I'm a man, you know, aren't I big and dangerous? And
that's very impressive.
You know what I mean? It gave me a big thrill to be seen. I mean, way back then. So, you know, it's just like the whole thing of opium and, you know,
all the mysteries.
Boogeyman, you know.
Yeah, all the mysteries of life, yeah.
You know, it's controversy, it's all that stuff. But, I mean, when I first heard his version of that song, that word, you know, because at that time I had been doing cocaine for a little while and was doing it, plus the groove, which is, you know, the thing that John does, you know, he finds these incredible sort of atmospheric grooves in his music. That the two things combined, well, I thought this is an irresistible song to do. If you wanna hang out,
figure out cocaine. If you wanna get down, down on the ground, cocaine. She don't like, she don't like, she don't like cocaine.
We're talking to Eric Clapton and J.J. Cale today on the World Cafe. On the new album, you also have a song called Danger.
Yes.
Is that the same sort of a track?
You know what? It has a, that's when I first heard Danger, when John sent me the songs that he'd written, that had the same effect on me. Because there's something about, you know, songs that are just one word title song that can just get you. And it just draws you in.
Before you even hear the song.
Danger, what's it going to be about? You know, and then you listen. And for me, that song had so much... It's a beautiful song because it's not what you expect it to be about at all. It's about actually the idea that there might be some poor girl out there on the street who's lost her way. You know, I picture this town, L.A., you know, where we are right now. The kind of people who come here and looking for a dream, and they get on the bus and they come here and they get off the bus in downtown L.A. and they look around and this is it.
It's exactly what it's about.
And it's so... It sums up so much, that song. It's funny that it really is like a modern cocaine.
Danger, she's out in tonight. Danger, she's such a pretty sight. She was treated so badly, it seemed. Now she's looking for a dream. Danger, she's out into the night. Danger, she walks the streets alone.
Songs that you had written, Lay Down Sally.
Yeah.
You had said at one point that you modeled it on Jay's writing.
Yeah.
How so?
Really, just talking about that thing that I mentioned earlier, that trying to find a groove.
The groove.
A pocket or a groove that was similar to what his standard thing was. So it's just like finding a way to play that and then come up with some kind of theme or notion, and all I had was a title, Lay Down Sally. I thought it was provocative, and you know, you could read something sexual into that or whatever, and then I couldn't come up with any more. So I came up with the pocket and the music, and Marcy Levy, who was singing with me at the time, wrote all the words out, and that was that. And it went up in the country music charts.
Yeah, it actually one of the more country things you did in that era.
I know. First time I've ever been recognized in
country. It kind of sounded country.
There is nothing that is wrong in wanting you to stay here with me. I know you've got somewhere to go, but won't you make yourself at home and stay with me? Don't you ever leave. Lay down, Sally, and rest here in my arms. Don't you think you want someone to talk to? Lay down, Sally, no need to leave so soon.
Is there an album or a song that you particularly would want to be remembered for out of the stuff that you've written so far?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I like the thing. I'm probably one of the most proud things I've got is the Layla album. Right. I mean, I didn't even listen to that for a long time, and it was part of my history. And then, you know, just recently I started working with some guitar players who are very, very keen on. They listened to that a lot when they were kids, and we started to play that material again on tour. And I've had to look at it again, and see how good it is, because it's kind of like the way we made that record, the same way we made this record. You know, it was live on the floor a lot of the time, just making it up as we went along, and so it has the same kind of atmosphere. But I like that one. That's one of my favorite records.
Why did you stop listening to it for a while?
Just because it, trying to either be working on something current or just not. I don't listen to my own stuff very much anyway. I mean, unless I'm researching something or I'm trying to figure out something new to do on stage, I don't listen to my, unless I'm working something.
How about you? Is there something in particular?
I have made about 14 albums. One of them live, about 14 albums. And
I've not made an album that I can listen to. I've got songs on every album that I really like. What I need to do is just go out and, of course, the record company always gives you that best of kind of thing, I never ever, and they always put the obvious hits on it. If I went through my 14 albums, I could probably find a couple of songs on every album, take all those songs and put them on a disc and call that my favorite album. But I hear the flaws in all my stuff, and then I'll hear a couple of things, that was better than I thought it was at the time,
Are you kind of anonymous where you live? Can you kind of get away with
it? I am until this album. Well, my neighbors, I live in a semi-rural area. It's not rural, but it's also not urban. You can see track homes over in there. Everybody has about 3 acres. My neighbors finally figured out I was a musician. They didn't never heard of me, but they knew I played music and was kind of semi-retired. And then now there's articles coming out then, and they go, oh, that's who you are, right? And I go, yeah, I'm sorry, man, or please, I don't want to do autographs today. And
it seems like at times from things that I've read that you kind of admired the fact that Jay was able to kind of be a little bit more anonymous. Do you ever wish that that was more the path that your life had taken, that you had been able to kind of not be in the spotlight so much? Or,
well, when I'm not working, especially when I'm not on tour, that is the way my life is. I have a very quiet life, and apart from the odd person that spots me in the street and asks me, actually, even when that happens, people just usually say hello. In where I live, everyone knows who I am, but they don't really attach too much importance to it. They're too busy worrying about their own lives, And so it only kind of gets to be a hassle when I check into a hotel in New York or here or something. And then you got these guys that make a living out of autographs and selling guitar parts with signatures on. And those people can make my life a misery. They get very aggressive. And, other than that, I don't have any ambition to be famous or it's never really meant that much to me to be on TV or to be, well thought of or popular. I don't care that much. So we have a lot in common in that respect anyway.
Was the period where people were going around saying that you were a god scary?
Yeah, a little bit, because I thought, what they got wrong was they thought I had somehow invented this stuff. And that kind of aggravated me. It's always angered me when people think it's come out of nowhere, And I did my best to try and point it out, that I'm just I'm just copying people that I really love, And I name names, I would tell them who it was, it didn't seem to make any difference because people just want to, they want to idolize people.
Yeah, you still seem to end up on a lot of the Rolling Stone still puts you on the top of guitarist lists.
Well, that's very nice. I got no problem with that. I'd rather be, all right. It's nice to get recognition. I like being recognized. Most of all, to be honest with you, I don't set any great stock in magazines. Magazines are scary things. They've often made me feel less than, because it's all right, like you say, when you're on the top of the list. But lists, I think, are nasty things. And people are always trying to get me, magazines like that, they always going to call my office. Can we get Eric's, top 100 records? And I say, no. I think it's an absolute poisonous way of looking at life. Lists, because then what about the people that get left out? I remember seeing Rolling Stone. You got me on one here. Rolling Stone did one of those things about top 100 albums of all time. Mm. And Radiohead were in that list like 3 times. And there were other people, like maybe even John and myself, who didn't even get mentioned. And then sometimes these things get, it's all fashion. It's fashion. So I like to be acknowledged and recognized by my peers, the people that I know work for the same value that I do and that are in it for the long haul. I guess also, I mean, you know, I'm a spiritual being. I like to be thought, I mean, I like to think there's a God somewhere that is kind of happy with what I've done. You know, I try to work to that as a principle too. I mean, and I went, you know, and I went through a period a long time not believing. And, you know, I had a little boy who died when he was 4. And you know, I used him as a measure of my behavior and say, well, what would he think of what you're doing right now? And I, you know, so you know, I've always had something in my life to measure my behavior by or my direction. And I think that's kind of useful.
Did that make you more spiritual, or is it that you've become more spiritual as you've gotten older?
I don't think I've ever been more or less. I just am kind of conscious of that I have a responsibility to my fellow man, which I think is just a spiritual axiom, you know, that I try to work towards, you know, I try to remind myself of on a daily basis.
How do you think that comes out in your music or your playing? Do you think it does?
I think it does. I mean, I'm conscious about trying to do the best I can and to make sure that I'm not leading anyone down the wrong path, you know. And to make clear that it is hard work and that it isn't, you know, it's got to be for the right reasons. That really, I'm just a servant of the music, you know. I'm not here. Music's not there for my purposes. I'm there to serve the music.
Eric Clapton, our thanks to Eric Clapton and J.J. Cale, and of course, World Cafe producer Kimberly Janod for that great session with the two of them.